A Story Publishing presents Yale Campus Walk, an audiobook tour of architecture, institutional history, and memory, 1701 present. Prologue. Imagine standing at the wrought iron arch of Phelps Gate on a crisp autumn morning in New Haven, Connecticut. The air carries the faint chime of distant bells, echoing across a verdant quadrangle where freshmen gather, their laughter mingling with the rustle of leaves. This threshold, framed by brick towers and stone carvings, isn't just an entrance. It's a portal to over three centuries of ambition, transformation, and debate. Here in the heart of Yale University, the past isn't confined to dusty tomes. It's etched into every facade, courtyard, and spire, inviting you to walk through history as it unfolds in stone and glass. The story begins in 1701, when 10 Congregationalist ministers pooled their books in a modest Connecticut settlement to found the Collegiate School, aiming to train clergy and civic leaders amid a young American colony. By 1716, the institution relocates to New Haven for better support, and in 1718, it adopts the name Yale College to honor Elihu Yale, a British merchant whose donations of books and goods provided early stability. Yet Yale's legacy is complex. As an East India Company official, he navigated an era of imperial trade that included the enslavement of people, sparking ongoing questions about how institutions reckon with their benefactors. Under leaders like Ezra Stiles, who in the late 1700s infused scientific inquiry into classical studies amid the American Revolution, and Timothy Dwight, whose early 1800s reforms expanded courses and tied the college to a burgeoning republic, Yale evolved from a clerical outpost into a broader seat of learning. Architects like James Gamble Rogers would later shape its physical form, blending collegiate Gothic, think pointed arches and intricate tracery evoking medieval scholarship, with modern needs, while innovators like Gordon Bunshaft introduced mid-century modernism, using materials like Vermont marble panels to protect rare manuscripts while bathing them in filtered light. This evolution unfolds across New Haven's streets and greens, where buildings stand as silent narrators of change. From the Georgian simplicity of Connecticut Hall, built in 1752 as part of the old brick row, to the enclosed quadrangles of late 19th century dormitories that fostered community over isolation, the campus mirrors shifting ideals of education. Professional schools emerge: medicine in 1810, divinity in 1822, law by 1824, culminating in the 1861 awarding of America's first PhD and the 1887 rebranding as Yale University. Through wars, social upheavals, and technological leaps, the institution grapples with its role: a bastion of tradition adapting to modernity, where enclosed courts give way to luminous cubes and Gothic towers coexist with concrete curves. At its core lies a profound tension. How does a university, born in an age of divine certainties, continually reinvent itself to house diverse minds and urgent inquiries? What does it mean when architecture not only shelters knowledge but shapes it, turning a library into a cathedral or a rink into a communal ark? These questions pulse through Yale's chronology, from founding ministers to contemporary presidents like Peter Salovey and Maury McGuinness, who steer expansions in access and innovation. As you linger at the gate, the bells toll again, a reminder that history here is alive, audible, and traversable. Step through, and this audiobook will guide you on an intimate walking tour, weaving Yale's timeline with its landmarks to reveal how spaces embody the pursuit of understanding. You'll emerge not just informed, but attuned to the echoes of progress and paradox that define an enduring institution. The journey starts now. End of prologue. This section draws primarily on Yale's official archives and published institutional histories, with architectural context from campus historians. Subsequent references simply cite the archive or the historians. The aim is steady: learn the early history while moving through the places that still carry it. The archive records the founding in 1701 as the Collegiate School, created by 10 Congregationalist ministers who pool books to educate clergy and civic leaders. the school relocates to New Haven in 1716 and in 1718 takes the name Yale College to honor benefactor Elihu Yale. Architectural historians note that the physical core that grows from that start, first a line of early buildings, then enclosed courts, expresses changing ideas about community, scholarship, and identity. Those two records, the archive and the historians, frame what follows. The walk begins at Phelps Gate on College Street, the formal entry into Old Campus. The gate's central arch and flanking towers read as a threshold to a green quadrangle lined with brick and stone. Beyond it, Georgian brickwork, multi-paned sash windows, movable framed glass panes, and stone lintels set a tone formed in the 18th century and elaborated in the 19th. The lawns inside host first-year gatherings that link a new class to a very old place. Beginning here matters because this ground is the oldest continuous stage for Yale's story, and the surrounding facades still teach by example. Within the first few steps, the chronology comes into view. The archive places the founding as a clerical project, the move to New Haven as a bid for civic support and centrality, and the 1718 naming as part of a wider 18th century pattern of philanthropy in higher education. A brief two-lens frame helps with an early controversy attached to that name. In claim world, admirers present Elihu Yale as a key donor whose gifts, including books and goods, help stabilize the fledgling college. In the public record, ledgers and company histories document his role as an East India Company official involved in overseas trade at a time when that trade includes the trafficking of enslaved people. Open questions remain about how institutions should contextualize honorific names tied to imperial commerce. The archive shows periodic reviews, and the discussion continues without easy consensus. The same arch that welcomes students today also frames conversations about how the past is remembered on stone, seal, and syllabus. Just ahead on the left stands Connecticut Hall, completed in 1752. The historians identify it as a Georgian survivor of the old brick row, the linear string of buildings that once organized the early campus. Its scale, modest by later standards, and its Flemish bond brickwork with simple stone trim preserve an 18th century idiom that later dormitories echo by choice rather than necessity. As the decades turn, the line of the row gives way to courts. In the late 19th century, red brick dormitories such as Farnham and Durfee help pivot the plan toward enclosed quadrangles modeled on English collegiate precedents. The hinge is practical and cultural at once. Courts quiet the interior from the street and concentrate student life. The change is not merely aesthetic, it is policy made stone, favoring community over corridor. In planning documents of the era, campus leaders write about the social benefits of inward-facing courts, treating architecture as a tool for habits as much as for shelter. Building on this foundation, the institutional arc widens. The archive traces a curriculum that begins with classical languages, divinity, and moral philosophy, then broadens under presidents who leave unusually detailed records, including Ezra Stiles in the late 1700s and Timothy Dwight in the early 1800s. Both press for scientific study alongside the classics and help knit Yale to a growing republic. Stiles's diaries and correspondence track intellectual currents and local affairs. Dwight's sermons and administrative notes document an energetic expansion of courses and faculty. The American Revolution and later the Civil War touch campus in ways the ledgers and minutes register, altered enrollments, military training, memorials, and they precede a post-war drive to professionalize. The shift from a college serving a clergy and classics curriculum to a university supporting wider professions is gradual and visible in the very names of new schools. That professional turn appears in the chronology as specialized programs form: medicine in 1810, divinity in 1822, law by 1824. In 1847, the Sheffield Scientific School opens a channel for engineering and applied science. And in 1861, Yale awards the first American Doctor of Philosophy, or PhD, marking a turn toward research norms that align with European models. By 1887, the title Yale University formalizes what the record already shows: multiple schools, a growing faculty, and governance that is no longer exclusively clerical, but shared among trustees and professors through modern committees. The shift in authority from a parish-like board to something closer to a board and a senate, each with defined roles, supplies the scaffolding for the research enterprise that later buildings and collections must house. A few minutes into the walk, the route trends west across the green and out toward Cross Campus, the broad lawn that acts as an outdoor reading room between libraries. The change in space anticipates a change in scale. Ahead rises the towered mass of Sterling Memorial Library, opened in 1931 and designed by James Gamble Rogers, the architect whose interwar commissions set much of Yale's central look. The historians describe the style as collegiate Gothic, a modern adaptation of medieval forms, pointed arches, tracery in window patterns, and leaf-like crockets, recast in steel-framed buildings with modern services. Rogers' programmatic idea, visible from the first steps inside, is to use the narrative language of a cathedral to honor study. A long, nave-like entrance hall leads to reading rooms and departmental libraries. Iconographic windows and stonework depict crafts, disciplines, and episodes from the university's past. The archives, building files, and the architect's correspondence present this as both symbolic and functional. Centralized collections dispersed across campus and create a processional experience that dignifies daily scholarship. Contemporary accounts note that when Sterling opens, visitors come to see not only the stacks and study spaces, but also the carved programs that fold academic life into stone. Reviewers at the time point out the deliberate paradox: modern fireproof construction cloaked in carved limestone so that durability meets tradition at the threshold. For orientation, think of the building as a carefully staged prologue to a book. The foreword and title page are elaborate, but the book's content, the research itself, remains the central act. Standing on Cross Campus clarifies the larger point. The library translates the interwar settlement of Yale's identity into architecture, forms tied to an Anglo-American imaginary, purpose tied to modern research. The result anchors many mental maps of the university as firmly as Old Campus anchors the historical one. The same institution that begins with a handful of donated volumes now invests in a cathedral-scaled machine for reading. From Sterling, the walk turns north toward Grove Street. The blocks compress, and the sky opens onto a plaza where a radically different library reframes light and mass. Completed in 1963 and designed by Gordon Bunshaft of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, the Banach Rare Book and Manuscript Library presents a square volume lifted on pilatus, supporting columns that raise the building. Each face a grid of bronze framing thin Vermont marble panels. The historians describe the facade as thin stone set within a structural lattice, transmitting daylight while filtering ultraviolet light, a strategy that allows a luminous dusk within, calibrated to protect manuscripts. At the center stands a glass tower of book stacks that reads like a lantern. The archive notes the Beineck family gift that makes the project possible, and the mid-century confidence that a purpose-built envelope could rehouse rare collections previously scattered and sometimes difficult to access. Here, too, a two-lens frame is useful because modernism on a traditional campus attracts claims. In claim world, admirers present the Banach as a pure architectural statement, an emblem of mid-century faith in technology and design. In the public record, planning memos and contemporary reviews document both praise and skepticism at the opening. Some welcome the new formal language, others worry about contrast and context. Open questions remain, not about whether it works. Its environmental performance and curatorial program are well established, but about how a campus should curate contrast across generations of building without losing coherence. A compact analogy helps. Like arranging a shelf where early printed books and contemporary paperbacks sit side by side, the task is to let differences speak without letting any one voice drown out the rest. Practically, this shows the library system's growth from donated volumes to a constellation that must both preserve the rare and serve the everyday. Circling back to anchor the chronology where the walk began, the early 20th century consolidates trends already in the record. Professional schools expand their programs, faculty governance matures, alumni philanthropy funds construction at a pace visible in the stones around Old Campus and the arcades flanking Cross Campus. Through these years, the archive records participation in national mobilizations and the gradual redefinition of student life away from a single college toward a university composed of schools and soon residential colleges, a development the next part takes up. As the curriculum broadens and research deepens, the campus plan absorbs those ambitions, moving from a few rooms of lectures and recitations to laboratories, seminar libraries, and specialized collections that need purpose-built homes. Each style, Georgian, collegiate Gothic, and mid-century modern, becomes a date stamp on those needs and ideals. Before turning the page to the next half hour, gather the pieces in place. Old Campus, with Connecticut Hall as a Georgian marker, and the late 19th century red brick dormitories forming courts, records a shift from a linear row to community-oriented quadrangles. Cross Campus, fronted by Sterling Memorial Library's 1931 Collegiate Gothic, frames learning as both daily practice and ritual passage. Grove Street's plaza, dominated by the 1963 Bainick, trusts light, stone, and glass to keep the rare visible and safe. Across two centuries, the archival timeline, founding in 1701, naming in 1718, the addition of medicine in 1810, divinity in 1822, law by 1824, the Sheffield Scientific School in 1847, the first American PhD in 1861, and university status in 1887, threads through these spaces, while the historian's notes on plans and facades make the chronology legible to the eye. From the luminous cube of the Bainick, the route turns south and west to the High Gothic of Harkness Tower and the residential college system, then on to the museums and science precincts that show how the story of scholarship and space continues. According to Yale's archives and published campus guides consulted in 2024, the route now turns south and then west from the luminous cube of the Bainick toward High Street. Subsequent references simply call these sources the archive or the guides. Harkness Tower rises ahead above the Memorial Quadrangle, the Collegiate Gothic Ensemble by James Gamble Rogers that frames Branford and Saybrook Colleges. Completed in 1921, the tower is a filigreed shaft of limestone and sandstone, its niches filled with carved figures that nod to scholarship and craft. Inside hangs a 54-bell carillon, tuned bells played from a keyboard, whose music marks hours, seasons, and ceremonies. Alumni often recall how a noontime peal or a commencement fanfare becomes a timestamp for memory. The tower is not just a skyline marker. The guides explain that Rogers pairs vertical drama with a lattice of courts, entries, and arcades, so that movement to meals, seminars, and practice rooms passes through cloisters and under lanterns. Like a metronome for a city of learning, the tower makes time audible, and the quadrangle translates daily routines into a shared ritual of place. Just beyond, the residential college system takes shape in stone. The archive and Rogers correspondence record the early 1930s creation of an Oxford-Cambridge collegiate model underwritten by philanthropist Edward S. Harkness. The idea is simple and ambitious. Divide a large college into smaller communities, each with its own dining hall, library, common room, and courtyard life, and tie them to the larger university by proximity and tradition. An initial group opens in the early 1930s, with additional colleges completed later in the decade. They broaden the intimate scale beyond the Memorial Quadrangle's courts to places like Trumbull, Davenport, Pearson, and Jonathan Edwards, and soon Silliman and Timothy Dwight. Early press at the time notes the novelty of students eating and studying in their own houses, an urban village woven into the campus grid. The system endures, not as a throwback, but as an administrative and architectural strategy. Faculty leaders help steer academic life, while advisors, fellows, and student organizations root themselves in the courts. Why this matters. The plan threads academic ambition through belonging, making community a deliberate choice rather than an afterthought. A contrast helps fix the idea. In the early 1960s, Eero Saarinen designs Morse and Ezra Stiles colleges on a nearby site. The guides characterize them as a modernist counterpoint to Gothic Yale, bush-hammered concrete walls, irregular windows, and pinwheel courtyards that wind rather than march in line. The forms favor asymmetry and surprise. The entries and paths pull students along diagonals that open and close like a set of small theaters. Compared to Rogers' cloisters, Saarinen's concrete reads as a mid-century wager that a different geometry could foster a different kind of social life, as if the plan itself were a studio exercise in how paths, not just portals, make community. Why this matters? It shows the institution testing whether new forms, materials, plans, even the feel of a hand on a textured wall, can recalibrate how students gather, study, and rest. Fast forward to 2017, and two more colleges open at the north edge of the historic precinct, Pauli Murray and Benjamin Franklin, designed by Robert A. M. Stern Architects. The archivists and press releases describe them as contemporary collegiate Gothic. Pointed arches and stone detailing outside, modern systems and accessibility within. They expand undergraduate capacity, ease pressure on housing, and integrate updated sustainability measures and flexible classrooms. Their courts and gates rhyme with the 1930s, but their plans carry practical lessons from late 20th century student life. Kitchens, performance rooms, and study areas wired for current research habits. Why this matters? The new colleges stitch growth to identity, using a familiar grammar to write new sentences. The chronology that weaves through these courts is as dense as the masonry. The archive traces an interwar building campaign, Sterling Library, the Memorial Quadrangle, new facilities for sciences and arts, followed by Second World War mobilization, accelerated courses, military training programs, and research aligned with national needs. The Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, widely known as the GI Bill, federal education benefits for veterans, brings veterans to campus in large numbers, reshaping classrooms and budgets. This passage offers general educational context, not individualized financial advice. Consider personal circumstances or consult a qualified fiduciary when making financial decisions. Post-war, Cold War funding strengthens laboratories. The social sciences and area studies grow alongside physics and biomedicine. In 1969, Yale College admits women, building on earlier co-education in professional and graduate schools, and the undergraduate experience changes in pace with that decision. In the decades that follow, the record shows expansions of financial aid and admissions practices aimed at widening access. The pattern, new programs, new centers, new support structures, continues into the 21st century as institutes for global health, data science, and quantum research join older strengths in the humanities and social sciences. Why this matters? Policy and investment decide who can be present and what work can be done. Architecture then answers by providing durable rooms for that work. Two contested episodes benefit from a two-lens frame. In 1970, during the New Haven Black Panther trials, claim world divides sharply. Supporters describe Yale as a mediator that protects speech and reduces harm by opening facilities, postponing some classes, and coordinating logistics for large crowds. Critics describe Yale as either enabling unrest or aligning with authorities, depending on perspective, and fault it for decisions that, in their view, imperil safety or foreclose dialogue. In the public record, administrative memos, contemporaneous news reports, and university statements show campus leaders working with city and state officials, adjusting schedules, and setting standards for conduct, while policing and legal processes proceed outside the university's control. Open questions remain about town gown obligations, how an elite campus should share responsibility and space during civic crises, and what practices best balance expression, learning, and safety. Why this matters? Universities meet history at their gates, and those choices echo in policies and relationships long after a protest ends. In 2016 and 2017, the renaming of Calhoun College follows a similar pattern of claims anchored to the public record. In Claim World, one side argues for retention as a reminder of complex history and as a cautionary marker. Another side argues that honoring John C. Calhoun, a political leader who defended slavery, inflicts harm and miseducates by normalizing the honor. In the public record, a university committee sets principles for renaming, gathers input, and issues a recommendation. Leadership then approves renaming the college for computer scientist and Navy officer Grace Hopper in 2017. Open questions persist about scope and precedent, which honors warrant review, how evidence should weigh against tradition, and how to teach history without erasing or celebrating injustice. Why this matters. Names on buildings are part of the curriculum. Deciding them is civic work, not a footnote. The walk bends east to Chapel Street, and then north along York to a pair of museums that place Yale on the wider map of art and architecture. The campus guides and museum publications describe the Yale University Art Gallery, a 1953 building by Louis Wan Khan that pairs brick with glass and a distinctive tetrahedral ceiling in its main pavilion. It marks Khan's emergence as a leading voice, services placed with clarity, daylight treated as a material. Across the street, the Yale Center for British Art opens in 1977, Khan's last building. Its stainless steel, travertine, and oak establish a calm interior where art reads in natural light filtered through skylight systems. A useful analogy here is the eggshell. Light but strong, the structure's disciplined geometry carries the load while freeing generous, quiet galleries. Both museums are open to the public, tie the university to city and region, and make their collections part of everyday life for students and neighbors alike. Why this matters? When a university treats collections as civic assets, it turns studying into a public practice. A few blocks northeast stand Woolsey Hall and the adjoining Commons, completed in 1901 by Carrere and Hastings and recently renovated as the Schwarzman Center. The archive describes Woolsey's Beaux-Arts massing as a ceremonial hall with a large pipe organ and a long tradition of concerts, convocations, and lectures. Commons, remodeled within the Schwarzman Project, now houses food, performance, and program spaces designed to serve the whole campus. The renovation keeps the original volume while threading in flexible rooms, accessibility, and new services. Why this matters? Shared rooms shape shared culture. They are where the university speaks to itself. North again, up Prospect Street, Science Hill gathers mid-century ambition and current sustainability. The record highlights the Klein Biology Tower from the 1960s, a tall, ribbed structure by Philip Johnson and Associates that signals a vertical turn in laboratory planning when land tightens and research expands. Its frank concrete and structural rhythm align with brutalism as a language of research at scale. Nearby, Kroon Hall opens in 2009 as a home for environmental studies with a high-efficiency envelope, daylighting, and water-conserving systems, reflecting a university-level push to shrink operational footprints. At the foot of the hill, the Peabody Museum, founded in the 19th century, reopens in 2024 after a major renovation and expansion. New galleries, updated interpretation, and improved access reframe a storied natural history collection for current audiences, with an emphasis on teaching and the public. Why this matters? When labs, classrooms, and museums sit in mutual reach, discovery circulates beyond the bench or display case. The route arcs west for two more structures that read as engineering and management lessons in form. On Prospect Street, Eero Saarinen's 1958 Ingalls Rink, often nicknamed the Whale, curves under a central catenary spine with cables and timber purlins that suspend the roof. The effect is a taut shell that hosts hockey and community events with grace. North of the center, Foster Partners 2014 Edward P. Evans Hall houses the School of Management in a glassy quadrangle around a central courtyard, with classrooms and commons arranged to encourage circulation and crosstalk among fields and visitors. One can think of it as a conversation engine in built form. Why this matters? Buildings can script collaboration and performance as surely as syllabi do. Leadership threads through this built record. The archive and major news coverage outline a late 20th and early 21st century sequence in which presidents and provosts expand financial aid, recruit broader cohorts of students and faculty, and seed institutes in biomedicine, global health, data-intensive scholarship, and quantum science. From 2013 to 2024, the presidency of Peter Salovey emphasizes access, partnerships, and research growth. In 2024, Maury McGuinness becomes president, and the handoff continues work on campus renewal, academic priorities, and community engagement. The precise programs will evolve, but the pattern, connecting resources to people and purpose, remains a stable thread. A synthesis helps close the loop. Georgian brick on old campus frames foundational discipline and enclosure. Rogers's Gothic makes community and memory visible. Mid-century modernism in the Beinecke, Morse, and Stiles bets on technology and new social forms. Brutalist and late modern towers on Science Hill embody research at scale. Contemporary glass and renovated halls signal openness, sustainability, and collaboration. Styles are not costumes. They are claims about what a university values at a given moment. Turning back toward the green, the listener passes again within earshot of Harkness's bells. The chime marks the present, while the stones keep the past at hand, and the route returns to the starting point with the sense that architecture and chronology are at Yale, the same story told in two languages. According to Yale's official archives and published campus guides consulted through 2024, the route now turns from the luminous cube of the Beinecke toward High Street. Subsequent references simply call these sources the archive or the guides. The Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library, completed in 1963 by Gordon Bunshaft of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill, is a poised square, lifted on columns, each face a lattice of bronze holding thin Vermont marble that glows like parchment when sun passes behind it. Within, a glass tower of books stands like a lantern. The record ties the building to a mid-century belief that engineering and design can solve problems. Filter light to protect fragile paper, yet keep the idea of a library visible. In claim world, admirers praise it as a courageous departure on a traditional campus. The public record of planning memos and debut reviews shows both enthusiasm and concern about contrast. Open questions remain about curating difference across generations of construction so that coherence is kept without flattening variety. Why this matters? The library demonstrates that protection and display can coexist, a principle that will guide other choices about how Yale houses and shows its work. Leaving the marble glow behind, a few minutes south and west, Harkness Tower resolves on the skyline over the Memorial Quadrangle, the Collegiate Gothic, a scholarly medieval revival ensemble by James Gamble Rogers that later organizes Branford and Saybrook Colleges. Completed in 1921, the tower is a filigree of stone sheltering a 54-bell carillon, bells played from a keyboard, whose music marks hours and rites. During terms, student carillonneurs keep a steady schedule of recitals, and on commencement mornings, the bells weave across old campus like an oral banner. The archive and the guides present Rogers's larger intention, a lattice of entries, courts, and cloisters that turns movement into encounter. The vertical drama makes time audible. The courts make community visible. Why this matters? A campus is not only a set of rooms, but a choreography of thresholds, and here the choreography aims to bind daily routines to a shared cadence. From those courts, the residential college system takes formal shape in the early 1930s. The archive and Rogers' correspondence trace the project to Edward S. Harkness, who underwrites a Yale translation of the Oxford-Cambridge model, a large college subdivided into smaller communities, each with dining hall, library, and common room, tied back to the university by proximity and practice. Early press notices marvel at students now eating, studying, and sleeping in their own houses, a civic village of scholarship threaded into city blocks. It is part architecture, part governance. fellows and advisors anchor academic life to place. Why this matters? Belonging becomes a designed element, not a byproduct, and the college model endures shifts in enrollment and curriculum because it is built into daily life. A contrast fixes the point. In the early 1960s, Eero Saarinen designs Morse and Ezra Stiles colleges nearby. The guides characterize them as modernist counterpoint. Textured concrete, irregular windows, pinwheel courtyards, diagonal paths that open and close like small stages. Compared with Rogers's cloisters, Saarinen's geometry wagers that surprise, not symmetry, will bring people together, like a footpath through a field that invites detours rather than a straight promenade. Why this matters? The institution tests whether different forms, materials under the hand, routes underfoot, can recalibrate how students gather and rest. Fast forward to 2017 at the campus's north edge, where two more colleges open, Pauli Murray and Benjamin Franklin, designed by Robert A. M. Stern Architects. The archive and project releases describe them as contemporary collegiate Gothic, familiar stone and arches outside, modern systems within. They expand undergraduate capacity and integrate sustainability features and accessible design. Their plans fold in lessons from late 20th century student life, with flexible study rooms, performance spaces, and kitchens. Why this matters? Growth ties to identity by a grammar people already read, while the interiors answer current needs. A distinct case study clarifies stewardship across eras. The guides document the phased renovation of the Yale University Art Gallery, Louis Wincan's 1953 debut on campus. The project restores the signature tetrahedral ceiling and reconnects adjacent buildings to create continuous galleries, preserving Kahn's disciplined handling of light while upgrading structure and services. In claim world, some purists argue that any alteration dilutes an original. The public record shows curators and architects working from drawings and material studies to keep in tension while meeting codes, access, and climate control. The practical implication for campus planning is plain. Existing masterpieces can be made to serve current teaching without surrendering their character if the work is patient and well documented. Why this matters? Universities inherit buildings the way they inherit libraries. The task is to keep them readable. The chronology underfoot broadens through national storms and shifts. In the interwar years, building accelerates. Sterling Memorial Library, the colleges and laboratories align with a confident research agenda. During World War II, the archive records accelerated terms, military training, and faculty projects tied to national needs. After 1944, the Servicemen's Readjustment Act, widely known as the GI Bill, a United States law funding veterans' education, brings veterans into classrooms and labs at scale and reworks budgets and pedagogy. In 1969, Yale College admits women as undergraduates, extending earlier coeducation in professional and graduate schools. The guides and news accounts describe a rapid change in daily life and a steady widening of fields of study. Photographs at the time show first-year women carrying boxes through old campus gates, a visible shift that redefines residence halls and classrooms alike. In the decades that follow, endowment growth funds expansions in financial aid and the creation of programs across the sciences, social sciences, and humanities, ethnicity, gender, and area studies among them, alongside investments in engineering, biomedicine, and data-intensive work. Why this matters? Who gets to be here and what they can study are policy choices first. Buildings then fix those choices in durable rooms. Two contested episodes benefit from a two-lens frame. In 1970, during the New Haven Black Panther trials, claim world splits. Some present Yale as mediator opening facilities, postponing some classes, and coordinating logistics to protect expression and reduce harm. Others cast the university as either enabling unrest or aligning with authorities and fault its choices on safety or dialogue. In the public record, administrative memos, contemporaneous reporting, and university statements show leaders working with city and state officials, adjusting academic schedules, and setting conduct standards while legal processes run beyond campus, including large demonstrations on and around the New Haven Green. open questions remain about town gown obligations, how to share responsibility and space in civic crises, and how to balance speech, learning, and safety. Why this matters. Decisions made at the gate echo for decades in trust and practice. In 2016 and 2017, the renaming of Calhoun College follows a similar structure. In claim world, one side argues for retention as a cautionary marker. Another argues that honoring John C. Calhoun, a defender of slavery, miseducates and harms. In the public record, a university committee articulates principles, gathers input, and recommends change. Leadership approves renaming the college for computer scientist and Navy officer Grace Hopper in 2017. Open questions persist about scope and precedent, what counts as an honor that warrants review, how to weigh evidence and tradition, and how to teach difficult history without erasing it or enshrining it. Why this matters. Names are part of the curriculum. Deciding them is civic work. The walk bends east to Chapel Street and north along York to two museums that place Yale on a wider cultural map. The guides present the Yale University Art Gallery as Kahn's crisp debut, pairing brick and glass with daylight treated as a shaping material and services handled with clarity. Across the street, his 1977 Yale Center for British Art uses stainless steel, travertine, and oak to create quiet galleries under carefully managed skylight systems. Together, they signal that collections are civic assets as much as academic ones. Why this matters? When a university opens its holdings, it trains not only students, but neighbors in how to look. A few blocks northeast, Woolsey Hall and the adjoining commons, completed in 1901 by Carrere and Hastings, and renewed as the Schwarzman Center, anchor a ceremonial axis. The archive describes Woolsey as a Beaux-Arts hall with a major pipe organ and a long tradition of concerts, convocations, and talks. Commons is recast within the renovation as a campus-wide hub for food, performance, and programs. The renewal keeps the grand volume and threads in flexible rooms and access. Why this matters? Shared halls are where a university addresses itself. Up Prospect Street, Science Hill gathers mid-century ambition and present sustainability. The record highlights the 1960s Klein Biology Tower, a tall, ribbed structure by Philip Johnson and Associates that reads as brutalism, raw concrete monumentalism, answering research at scale when land tightens. Nearby, Kroon Hall opens in 2009 as a home for environmental studies with a high-efficiency envelope, daylighting, and water-conserving systems. At the foot of the hill, the Peabody Museum reopens in 2024 after a major renovation and expansion that reframes a storied natural history collection for teaching and the public. Long familiar displays join reinterpreted galleries so that dinosaurs, ecosystems, and regional geology become tools for coursework as well as weekend visits. Why this matters? Proximity among labs, classrooms, and museums lets discovery circulate beyond the bench or case. Two more structures frame practice and exchange. On Prospect Street, Eero Saarinen's 1958 Ingalls Rink, the Whale, curves under a central spine with cables and timber purlins suspending the roof, a taut shell that handles sport and community events with the same grace. On winter evenings, the combination of ice, lights, and the swooping roof turns a game into a small civic festival. North of the center, the 2014 Edward P. Evans Hall by Foster Plus Partners gathers the School of Management around a glassy court with classrooms and commons designed to promote circulation and conversation. The courtyard works like a small urban plaza where chance crossings become collaboration. Why this matters? Buildings can script collaboration as surely as syllabi do. A counterargument deserves space before we close. Some observers contend that building new colleges in updated Gothic repeats an idealized past rather than meeting a present. Others reply that continuity aids wayfinding, unifies a diverse precinct, and meets student expectations while hiding modern systems inside familiar walls. The public record of planning documents, presentations, and reviews shows cost, maintenance, energy performance, and urban fit weighed alongside symbolism. The practical implication is that style choices are not merely aesthetic. They carry commitments about stewardship, identity, and how quickly people learn a place. A campus can embrace adjacency, Gothic next to modern, if it is clear about what each is doing and if paths and programs stitch them together. Leadership threads through the built story. The archive and major news coverage outline late 20th and early 21st century presidencies and provostships focused on widening access, recruiting broader cohorts, and seeding institutes in biomedicine, global health, data-intensive scholarship, and quantum science. From 2013 to 2024, Peter Salovey emphasizes access, partnerships, and research growth. In 2024, Maury McGuinness becomes president, with work continuing on campus renewal, academic priorities, and community engagement. Why this matters? Changes in program and policy precede changes in stone and glass, and each administration leaves both documents and doorways. A synthesis ties the arc to what the eye sees. Georgian brick on old campus signals early discipline and enclosure. Rogers's collegiate Gothic makes community and memory visible. Mid-century modernism in the Beineck, Morse, and Stiles bets on technology and new social forms. Brutalist and late modern towers on Science Hill embody research at scale. Contemporary glass and renewed halls signal openness, sustainability, and collaboration. Styles are not costumes. They are claims about value at a given moment. Turning back toward the green, the listener comes again within earshot of Harkness's bells. The chime marks the present while the stones keep the past at hand, and the loop closes where it began, with the sense that at Yale, architecture and chronology are the same story told in two languages. Thank you for choosing Astori Publishing.